Coming up, a Catholic writer and editor reacts to the church's sex abuse scandal. And Muslim parents who are educating their children at home.
We've chosen homeschooling for our children and our family to provide that, again, the strong values and strong foundation, as well as strong academics and strong respect and understanding of our faith, as well as respect for other faiths.
Plus, a personal journey. Managing editor Kim Lawton revisits the mission in Haiti that her grandparents helped establish there more than 30 years ago.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Pope Benedict XVI directly addressed the church sex abuse scandal this week. At the Vatican, the Pope told pilgrims in St. Peter's Square the church planned to take action in the face of allegations of abusive priests and negligent bishops. He did not elaborate, but soon afterward, the Vatican accepted the resignations of bishops in Ireland and Belgium because of the scandal. Last weekend, during a visit to Malta, Benedict met privately with victims of clerical sex abuse, and with them, he prayed and wept. The continuing crisis in the church has left millions of American Catholics sad, angry, and wondering what can be done to resolve it. We want to talk about that with Margaret Steinfels, former editor-in-chief of Commonweal magazine, now co-director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University. She joins us from New York. Peggy, welcome. How do you describe the range of reactions among the U.S. Catholic laity?
I think that many people are surprised that this has come back on the TV screen and the newspapers. American Catholics went through this a couple times before, most recently in 2002. And I would say that at this point, there is among many people a kind of battle fatigue. Why hasn't this been dealt with?
Has it increased divisions among Catholics here or increased divisions between the laity here and the hierarchy?
I don't know that it has. I guess we could say it has increased the ongoing factionalism of the church, where the right declares this is the problem of the sex revolution of the 60s and homosexuality in the clergy. People on the left say, no, no, if we had women priests, bishops, and cardinals, this would never happen. So I don't know that there are additions to this, but I think there are certainly ongoing factionalism among Catholics.
The church is a very top-down organization. Are there things that Catholics in the pews can do from the bottom up that might be helpful?
Of course, it's top down, but it's not the Marine Corps. And I do think that at the parish level, and my own parish, for example, the pastor has dealt with this forthrightly and directly. And I think the people in our pews, anyway, have a feel, well, here's somebody who really understands the problem and who is prepared to talk about it from the pulpit. I think that is a great benefit to those Catholics who actually still go to Mass. Of course, those who don't hear that message.
Mm-hmm. So what should Pope Benedict do?
Well, I think the whole Vatican needs to come to grips with this. They need to get the truth out. And so far as they know it, they should get it out quickly. And I guess they should stop blaming the messengers, whomever they may be.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the messengers have been exaggerating the story?
I've been a little surprised at the viral nature of the stories. And I do think that there has been a certain lack of professionalism among journalists in tracking down details of the stories. But again, I don't think we should blame the messengers. I think the Catholic Church needs to take this issue in hand and deal with it.
Margaret Steinfels of Fordham University, many thanks. In other news, some religious leaders are protesting a new immigration bill in Arizona. The measure would require police in the state to check the status of anyone they suspect may be in the country illegally. It would be the toughest law in the U.S. intended to prevent more illegal immigration. Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles, who's been outspoken in his calls for more liberal immigration policies, was among the critics. He likened the bill to a Nazi tactic and called it retrogressive and mean-spirited. In Washington, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case that could have far-reaching impact on religious groups. The case pits the University of California's Hastings School of the Law in San Francisco against a student chapter of the Christian Legal Society. Hastings refused to recognize the Christian group because it requires members to sign a statement affirming their Christian faith and agreeing with certain socially conservative views. Hastings says it's practicing non-discrimination. The student group says it's being denied freedom of association. In China, mourning continued after this month's deadly earthquake. More than 2,000 people were killed and 12,000 injured in the tragedy. Tibetan Buddhist monks have been helping with rescue efforts, organizing services for the dead, and offering prayers for the victims. In this country, many evangelical Christians homeschool their children, in part to insulate them from a public school culture they say conflicts with their religious values. Now, some Muslim Americans are doing the same thing. We have a story today from Bob Faw about two Muslim homeschool families in Northern Virginia.
In the heart of mainstream America, a Cub Scout derby where each of the home-designed cars is carefully weighed and measured before roaring off at breakneck speed. Here, enterprise, ingenuity, and patience are justly rewarded.
My favorite part was when I got in first.
It's a mainstream event passionately embraced not only by the Jaka brothers, but also by 9-year-old Bilal Khan, whose education and upbringing is anything but mainstream.
How do you do that?
In his Loudoun County, Virginia home, Bilal is being taught math by his mother, Zakia.
So 5 is closer to 7 or 10 is closer to 7?
In another home nearby, Priscilla Martinez is teaching her 6 children, ages 2 to 12, about condensation.
We're going to learn about clouds, evaporation, condensation, and precipitation.
They are part of a growing movement, no one knows the exact number, of Muslims who homeschool their children because they want them to get a more holistic education than a public school can provide.
What we're trying to do is give our children a foundation within the family first and their identities with values. That's kind of the springboard for what it is that we would like for them to take with them throughout life.
And homeschooling lets these Muslim families focus on their faith. Using the computer, Bilal studies the Quran with a teacher from Pakistan, home of his father Maqsood and his mother.
Over there, we know that everything is Islamic based, but over here, we don't see Islamic way of life outside the house.
We're still tied to that country and want them to understand the culture and to learn about the religion.
And Priscilla's 12-year-old daughter, Hadaya Jacob, a 7th grader, helps her 8-year-old brother, Mikhail, to read the Quran.
It's better like this because we have the flexibility to do it whenever we want.
Muslim parents say homeschooling can provide a better learning experience because the work can be tailored to each child's needs. Bilal, for example, who learned to read before he entered public school, got bored when he had to wait for the other kids in his grade to catch up.
It was just not challenging enough for him. And so we felt that we could probably do a lot more to challenge them and to help them learn. They can learn more of what they like, what they feel comfortable with.
Like the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, they're all the domain.
In each home, the older children assist the younger siblings. When 15-year-old Mina Khan is not studying geometry, history, and literature, she helps her 14-year-old sister Heba with her math.
Allahu Akbar, Allah.
No matter what's going on, both families stop what they're doing to pray 5 times every day. All this, proponents argue, is part of instilling values which their children would not get in public schools.
We've chosen homeschooling for our children and our family to provide that, again, the strong values and strong foundation, as well as strong academics and strong respect and understanding of our faith, as well as respect for other faiths.
Are they getting a good education? Mina excelled in public school before starting homeschooling 4 years ago. She studies totally on her own with the help of a curriculum for homeschoolers. It takes discipline, she says, but she feels she's doing even better here than she did in public school.
I think I'm getting a very good education. I can go at my own pace. So if I understand something, I can go ahead. But if I don't understand something, I can slow down on it and review it and go over it again and get help if I need to.
It is a glowing picture, but some educators feel that children are better served in a school setting.
Okay, let's start today's session by talking about the poster for...
At the University of Maryland, where she helps train teachers, Melanie Killen worries that homeschoolers can be sheltered and miss the benefits of rubbing shoulders with different kinds of students.
Peer relationships are very different from sibling relationships. This is where you learn how to share, negotiate, how you learn how to resolve conflicts. There's a whole host of very important, fundamental building bricks and blocks for how we become members of a culture that come out of the peer interaction.
Muslim parents who homeschool understand the criticism and go to great lengths, they say, to expose their children to outside interests. To help integrate the kids into the culture, the Khans and Jakas go to scouting events, to classes at museums, and interfaith meetings. Exposed to different faiths, they also bring their faith to others.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic.
Here, they're not only part of the mainstream culture, they are totally caught up in it.
Today I got my car checked in, and I also got a patch, and I watched a lot of cars go down. It was really cool.
Activities like this, say Muslim homeschooling parents, show that their kids are not cloistered.
It's important to us, again, to make sure that, you know, the children get to know people and that that they're not sheltered, that they intermingle with people and they get to know the larger society.
We aren't looking to run away from the world and draw the blinds and shut everything and everyone out, living in our own little utopia. What we're looking to do, especially with our children, is to be out there, to get to know our neighbors.
While each of these families says they have experienced prejudice, they insist prejudice was not a factor in deciding to homeschool. But prejudice, say educators, can be subtle.
These are Muslim families living in a predominantly non-Muslim area. They have different conventions, dress, dietary practices, and all that. But there's also implicit forms of prejudice that people experience and oftentimes don't even call it that, but they're uncomfortable. They might feel excluded. There's this level of uncomfortableness about being in a school that's not part of their own culture and religion.
Another pitfall? While Priscilla and Zakia are both dedicated and smart, neither was trained as a teacher.
You need in the training in terms of learning how to be a teacher. You're managing a classroom of children, you're figuring out how to do this, but you're also aware of social development and children's social cognitive development, their biological development. These are all things that they need to know about.
To make sure homeschoolers are making progress, Virginia requires they meet certain requirements by taking a test, by interviewing with a certified teacher, or handing in a portfolio of their work.
Are they switching? Yeah, this one is blue.
Muslim homeschooling is still a small movement, but those who spend hours on the front lines are not crippled by any doubt.
Our goal is basically to bring up our children who are contributing citizens, who feel that they can and should give back to the world, and ultimately to grow up in peace and to be able to live a fulfilling life.
As a sign in her living room reads, "Home is where your story begins, here where the alphabet, arithmetic, and Allah meet." For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faugh in Loudoun County, Virginia.
The state of Virginia does not give homeschool children a high school diploma, but children can qualify for its equivalent by taking accredited correspondence courses or the GED. Civil rights leader Dorothy Height has died. She was 98. Height led the National Council of Negro Women for four decades and was also an advocate for international human rights. Finally, we have a special report from our managing editor, Kim Lawton. Since January, Kim has done several reports about faith-based relief efforts after Haiti's devastating earthquake. For Kim, the story had a personal dimension. Her grandparents, Wesley and June Churchill, were missionaries in Haiti for more than 20 years. On Kim's trip to Haiti last month, she visited the mission they helped establish.
Nestled among all the family photos at my grandparents' home are other memories as well. Art and gifts that symbolize their decades of work as missionaries in Haiti.
I made a scrapbook from my trip.
Wesley and June Churchill are in their 90s now, but still feel as connected to Haiti as they were more than 30 years ago when they first went there. My grandfather was a high school science teacher. As a United Methodist, he believed he was called to help others. So during breaks from school, he did various service projects. In the 1970s, he connected with a group of men who were drilling wells for clean water in Haiti. After Grandpa retired from teaching, he and Grandma decided to work more long-term there. They joined with a small group of other Christians to establish the non-denominational Haiti Gospel Mission in Despinos, a village about 45 minutes outside Port-au-Prince. They began a variety of projects, including a church, a school, and a medical clinic. My grandparents worked in Haiti until 1997, when Grandpa turned 80. A young missionary couple, April and Joel Hess, now lead the work in Despinos. When I was a teenager, my grandparents brought me there to visit. It was clear I wasn't cut out for missionary life.
I can remember you going in your bedroom and a squeal came.
Yeah.
She said, "Grandpa, there's a dead mouse in my shoe."
I remember that very vividly.
Grandpa took care of it.
Yeah.
I returned to Haiti last month, not as a missionary, but a reporter, covering the aftermath of the earthquake. And I went to Despinos to see what was happening at the mission today. I brought back some video to show my grandparents.
Is that Reno?
That's Reno.
Okay.
That's Reno.
That's Reno.
At the compound, Reno, who worked with my grandparents in the 1970s, still takes care of the grounds and helps keep things going.
Reno used to ride to Port-au-Prince with Grandpa, and he'd always say to me, "Mama, I garde Papa. I garde Papa. And he did. He'd have a big club with him.
Reno showed me the changes to the mission house.
April put that part, and Joel.
The house sustained only slight damage during the earthquake, including some cracks on the roof. And a small part of the compound walls came down. Reno told me all about my grandpa's influence on the mission, in big ways and small.
Big trees in Bonaparte is a rocket.
Brother Churchill liked the big tree.
Big
yeah,
tree.
He wanted to keep
Long
the tree.
Long time, he keep
yeah,
the tree.
He wanted to keep the tree.
It's on the trees, even a big, big tree.
Just up the road from the house is the Haiti Gospel Mission Church. Pastor Elison Bien-Aimé showed me the moderate damage there, most in the front of the building. The church has now raised enough money not only to repair the damage, but to add some columns to strengthen the building and an archway to make a more attractive entrance. Pastor Elison praised the construction work of my grandpa and another missionary, Melvin Barger.
Brother Churchill and Brother Barger did a good job.
I will tell my grandfather you said.
Exactly,
he did
he's a good engineer.
Because the church stands.
Yeah.
Elison grew up around the mission and was active in the church even as a boy.
He was always polite and really, really nice boy for a a boy from out there to
yeah.
go to school and go to seminary, and he's done well.
Ellison told me he believed the earthquake has actually strengthened people's faith in God. He said the church has been full every Sunday since. It was certainly full on this Sunday when he called me up front to bring greetings from my family.
My grandfather is 94 years old. After the earthquake, he said, "I want to go back and help them. I think he will help you with his prayers."
Ellison told me my grandparents had a big influence on him.
My grandma and grandpa.
Yeah, I'm today. Very happy to see them.
He's 94.
94, El, oh.
And she's 91.
Is it two monuments?
Two monuments.
Yeah.
At the Haiti Gospel Mission Satellite Church in Layagon, Pastor Gilles Pierre was also moved at seeing a current photo of my grandparents.
Ever since we established the church in Layagon, mm-hmm. he was with us.
So he's been there a long time.
Yeah, he's the only pastor that's been at that church.
The church here didn't fare very well. The building, as well as the parsonage and the school, were severely damaged. Pastor Gilles barely escaped.
This came down on your head?
Yes. God saw me.
God saw you? He saved you. God saved you. Yeah?
Layagon was near the epicenter of the quake, and about 80% of the town was destroyed. Pastor Gilles took me through a cornfield to show me the destruction at his wife's family's home. Most of his congregation members have lost everything. He hopes to rebuild, but for now, he worries about surviving day to day. The church has moved the worship services to a large tent donated by U.S. churches. It's difficult for my grandparents to hear such stories about their friends.
It's so sad because the poor people had nothing to begin with, hardly.
Yeah.
And now they...
But there were happy stories, too. After my appearance at church, old friends came to say hello. Some remembered when I had come before. Others wanted to meet the Churchill's granddaughter, or as they called me, Pitty Pitty Fee Churchill. As word of my visit spread, one old friend drove in from Port-au-Prince to see me.
It's my friend.
Yeah, from a long time ago. Huh?
Yeah, long time ago.
Yeah. That is Busha.
Yeah.
That's Busha. We've known him since he was a little boy. Yeah, that's Busha.
It's my friend.
Yeah.
The clinic my grandparents helped build is now thriving. There are two nurses on staff and a doctor who comes in every day, Monday through Friday. They see up to 20 patients a day. There's a large, well-supplied pharmacy. And the supervisor of the clinic, who also grew up at the mission, tells me that in the back room, they still plan on fulfilling my grandpa's dream of setting up a laboratory.
That was what grandpa's goal, was to get that finished.
Immediately after the earthquake, injured people flooded to the clinic from miles away seeking medical treatment. And many patients are still getting follow-up treatment.
I'm sure the clinic was supposed to be there for this purpose.
When I was there, Haitian schools had not yet reopened, so patients whose homes had been destroyed were living in the school. One was this woman, whose hand had to be amputated. Another was this girl, whose leg was injured.
I love you.
Before the quake, the school had 255 students, ages 3 to 15. The principal is Dulce Jean Almenois. He told me the Churchills did a good work, because without them, we would have no clinic or school or church. Because of them, the children will grow up here and be able to work. James Pierre is a Bible school student who lives at the mission and helps out. He never knew my grandparents, but says he's impressed by the Americans who continue to come there to work.
Sometimes there is no power, sometimes there is no water, sometimes there is, sometimes it's very, very hot, and they stay here to help. That's a good, a great thing. They help a lot here. This mission is very, very important for this community.
Many of the things my grandfather tried to introduce never fully caught on, like beekeeping and breeding stronger bulls, and cooking with solar energy. Still, my grandparents told me they're gratified to see that the work at the church, the clinic, and the school continues, even despite a devastating earthquake. A testament, Grandma says, to the resilience of the Haitian people. It's also a testament to the work my grandparents did, the lives they touched, and the legacy they leave behind. I'm Kim Lawton in Despinos, Haiti.
You can see the backstory of our cruise Haiti trip on our website at pbs.org. You can comment on our stories and forward them. Audio and video podcasts of the program are also available. And you can follow us on our Facebook page. I'm Bob Abernethy. As we leave you, a music video featuring some of gospel music's biggest names, led by Kirk Franklin. The song, Are You Listening?, was recorded to raise money to help rebuild Haiti.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.